You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. We thank you for listening. Tonight, we're going to talk about the expansion of presidential authority in the area of national security. It's at times been seismic and at other times subtle. The path of this expansion has been captured in a book of incredible scope that must be read and understood by every serious national security attorney and policymaker. The National Security Constitution in the 21st century captures the expansion of executive authority over more than 200 years, from before the drafting of Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution through today. And the book is written by one of the world's leading experts on international and constitutional law, Harold Hanju Ko, the Sterling Professor of International Law, the former Dean of Yale Law School. And Mr. Ko has served numerous U.S. presidents of both parties for over 35 years. He has served as the State Department legal advisor and the Assistant Secretary for Human Rights. And he's written 9 books, including the original book on this topic, The National Security Constitution. And he's received more than 30 human rights awards. Dean Ko, it is a pleasure to have you with us on NSLT. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure to be here.
Can you explain to our listeners what the founders viewed as the role of the president and Congress in national security and, I guess, international affairs as well, at the time of the drafting of the Constitution?
Yeah, just to simplify the message for the list, everyone assumed from high school days that checks and balances is the basic principle of the U.S. Constitution. But the question is, do those checks and balances stop at the water's edge? Within our Constitution is a sub-constitution that covers national security, which I called in the first version of this book, the National Security Constitution. What you're really asking is, what was the original design, and how has that design changed over more than 200 years? The original design was driven by the founders having two strong ambitions. One was to suppress the role of the states in foreign affairs and give more power to the federal government. But the other was to make sure that we didn't replicate a king, that there would be, instead of unilateral executive power with the king making all the decisions, shared power between all three branches of government, even in foreign affairs, namely the president acts, Congress disposes, and the courts oversee. In fact, the way they originally wrote the Constitution in 1789 gave most of the foreign affairs powers to Congress. And so Article 1 of the Constitution is replete with discussion of all Congress's foreign affairs power. But very early in our constitutional history, because of the structural advantages of the executive, even by the end of the Washington administration, the president had now taken the lead, even though he's in Article 2, not Article 1, and even though his enumerated powers are very small. But even then, Congress was very actively involved, and the courts basically played the same role that they now do of evaluating whether the president is or is not violating the law. What this book argues is that over time, the second two checks, congressional oversight and judicial accountability, have atrophied to the point where executive unilateralism is the order of the day.
How does the founders' vision of national security authority contrast with sort of the current view of executive authority, which appears to receive the blessing of the Supreme Court over and over and over again with respect to national security matters?
Well, I argue in the book that there are basically, through our history, two competing visions. What I consider to be the original vision of balanced institutional participation was really defined by the Supreme Court's decision in the Steele seizure case in 1952. Where the key concurring opinion was written by Justice Jackson. Ironically, Justice Jackson's law clerk was William Rehnquist, and William Rehnquist's law clerk was John Roberts. You would think that they would become an heir to this tradition of balanced institutional participation. But the competing view is one where the president can act essentially alone, executive unilateralism. And that vision was set forth in a Supreme Court case called U.S. versus Curtis Wright Export Corporation. And when I was in the Justice Department in the 80s, we used to call, jokingly, the Curtis Wright, so I'm right site. Because if you were invoking presidential power in foreign affairs, all you had to do was to cite that case, Hasim, in the brief, because the view of presidential power was so expansive. What I think I argue now is we currently have a Supreme Court where any number of the justices serve presidential power. You know, John Roberts was Deputy Solicitor General. Sam Alito worked in the Solicitor General's office. You know, Brett Kavanaugh was an executive branch lawyer. Elena Kagan was White House counsel. So we have a little bit of a left-right agreement on the president being the moving party whose actions should be deferred to by the justices. And they can do it in one of two ways. They can either say that the action, when it's challenged by private parties, there's no justiciability. The case cannot be reviewed on the merits because of lack of standing or political question or ripeness or mootness or some kind of immunity. Or they can say on the merits that the president has the power to act and just affirm that power. And the Roberts Court has been very aggressive on both of those fronts, the most recent example being the immunity decision in Trump versus the United States that was just decided a few months ago.
Okay, and to your factual summary, I think I would add, and I believe Justice Alito was also the U.S. attorney for New Jersey and presided over at least one, I think for that era, serious terrorism case involving a Japanese Red Army individual. And I think he personally came to court and argued portions of that, even as a political U.S. attorney. We all like to predict and anticipate what could cause a president to flex executive authority. And of course, in reading your book, I was trying to glean patterns and solutions to this sort of metastasizing executive authority. Are there specific situations in which presidents have sought to expand that authority that would reveal maybe a pattern of triggers, if you will?
Yeah. So if there's a theme of the book that I really want to emphasize, is it's not just about personalities. It's about structure. That presidents of both parties become unilateralists. Take Joe Biden, for example, who served in Congress longer than almost any president in our history. In his foreign affairs, particularly with regard to Israel, Hamas, he has behaved almost entirely unilaterally with almost no congressional participation and no issue has gone to court. And the main thing that drives this is a feeling of a crisis or emergency. When a crisis occurs, everybody expects the president to act. Everybody expects that Congress will do nothing. And everybody expects that the courts will not get involved or when they are called in late in the day, they'll simply reaffirm what the president does. And that's led to presidents claiming emergency even when emergencies don't really exist. You know, for example, we now have emergency economic sanctions that run against dozens of countries. Back when this was adjudicated before the Supreme Court in Reagan versus Wald, Justice Blackmun asked a question in the oral argument, you mean we're still in a state of emergency with regard to Cuba? And they said, yeah, it's existed for more than 50 years. In other words, once the emergency is declared, it doesn't end. In the Trump administration, these claims of emergency got more and more absurd and less connected to fact. For example, take the Muslim ban. They banned people coming in from 10 countries on national security grounds. And it turns out that nobody from those countries had ever committed a lethal killing against a U.S. citizen. Whereas one of the countries that they didn't put a ban on, Saudi Arabia, was the origination point for most of the 9/11 terrorists. Or when Trump wanted to build a wall and Congress wouldn't fund it, he said that the national emergency was Congress's failure to fund his proposed initiative. That was never struck down by the courts. The Muslim ban, of course, was upheld by our Supreme Court, where they gave credit to what Justice Sotomayor called in dissent a national security masquerade. And that's the real danger, that these national security masquerades will proliferate and be used as a pretext for more and more unilateral assertions of executive authority.
So this obviously leads me to the question about what you mentioned, which is the structural issue. Is there something with the way the government branches were designed to function that has fueled this steady expansion of executive authority? And listening to you right now on things like, you know, the Muslim ban, issues with respect to the wall, I mean, it seems like lately Congress hasn't been able to drive toward any legislation on its own on these specific topics.
Yeah, I mean, Congress has largely stopped legislating, and it's largely stopped holding meaningful hearings, and it's largely stopped having meaningful committee. And when it does that, it's very hard for even the expertise of particular members to get invoked. More than that, members of Congress don't like to vote on issues, because if they do, you know, for example, to authorize military action, that's one of the few things that can get them voted out of office. You know, take, for example, where we are right now in the Middle East. You know, we're in a delicate relationship with Netanyahu's government. They are on the verge of warfare against Hamas, which has been declared, Hezbollah, Iran, and various other Iran-backed groups. And then the United States is also being threatened by the Houthis, who are attacking our shipping in the Red Sea. So there's a real possibility that we could sleepwalk into a full-scale Middle East conflict in which Congress has never authorized any particular action.
And to your point, as of this recording, I believe we're moving some sort of military vessels into the region just a few days after senior leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah have been assassinated, and tensions in the Middle East are extremely high as we're recording.
Well, let me say, Elisa, that I know you have a family history with regard to the beginning of the Vietnam War, which you might indeed want to mention on this pod. But, you know, what happens is that these threats or perceived threats can lead to the executive branch feeling a need to respond with military action or to convince Congress to enact legislation based on certain facts that turn out not to be true. For example, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was based on a claim of the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and it turned out when they got in there, there weren't any. Even when Congress acts, it's not necessarily doing so based on accurate fact.
Yeah, and what you're referencing is my father served as a CIA scientist and was interpreting the data the night of the what has come to be called the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which involved alleged attacks by PT boats, Viet Cong PT boats on the SS Maddox. But, you know, this is now declassified, and my father and the captain of the Maddox, the person who was on the bridge that night, gave interviews, and neither one of them understood that the vessel was under attack. However, I do know that, according to my dad, I remember there was an afternoon paper, the Washington Star. And I think by the time he woke up the next day, having been up all night, the front page said we were escalating the war in Vietnam. And it did not appear to him that there was a basis. So I think that's what you referenced. But a lot of times, I think they're trying to rally people into not the public as well as members of Congress into feeling like they have to support one or the other action.
The point of my book is that this is not just a one-off. It's a historical pattern. In a time of crisis, the president reacts, and then the president asks Congress for some sort of emergency legislation. The Gulf of Tonkin was such a resolution, was one such example, but a much more graphic example was the authorization for the use of military force after 9/11. On September 18th, that still exists, and that's still being used as a basis for authority. And then there is the Iraq AOMF, which says that Congress is granting authority to the president to act against the situation in Iraq, which at the time meant Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein is long gone, but the statute is on the books. So what's happening is Congress is writing blank checks to the executive, which they're using in a game of find the statute, in a way that ends up putting a fig leaf authorization onto executive power.
That's alarming, considering the fact that U.S. citizens go fight these wars. That's really an alarming trend. I'm wondering, and this is sort of like, it sounds like I'm giving the amazing professor a question, but I'm wondering, can you pick out like maybe three or four times in history when executive authority exceeded just anything that could have been part of the drafter's imagination at the time?
You were nice enough, Elisa, to point out that the book tries to have a historical scope from the beginning of the Republic to the present. And what I try to do is identify seven eras of American history through which this relationship between Congress, the executive, and the courts operated. And usually it was a pendulum swing until we got to the late 20th century. And then really starting with Vietnam was sort of period number one. But before that, I would say the first of the four incidents I mentioned would be the Cold War, which is a dramatic expansion of presidential power combined with the technology. And this is an important point. Technology tends to fuel this trend, because if the president can launch a war by dropping an atomic bomb, then Congress's power to declare war suddenly goes out the window. Example number two, the Vietnam War, which showed a different technique, which I've described, which is find a statute or generate a statute, which comes to operate as a blank check. Then the third, which I highlight in some length in the book, is the Iran-Contra affair, where in an effort to essentially trade arms for hostages, the Reagan administration licensed a private foreign policy, which was conducted by people like Oliver North and also passed on by members of the cabinet, all of whom got pardoned. Nothing happened in response to that to fix this structural problem. And then the latest example, which I lay out in a lot of detail, was the Trump administration, which may be the first Trump administration. Because what we saw there was really something quite singular. There is a president who saw himself as having total Article II power. He articulated the Curtis Wright theory as his governing theory, which meant that anything challenging him from within the executive branch is a violation of the unitary executive. Any challenges to him from outside the executive branch he considers unconstitutional. And then he showed that you can fight subpoenas all the way through the courts. You can claim immunity. If individuals conduct criminal activity, they can be pardoned by the president. Impeachments, as long as you're holding on to the House, will never go all the way to removal of office. And then even after he left office, we've learned that you can take classified papers and suffer no consequence, or you could even face immunity for acts that claim to have been done in their official capacity. The reason why this is ironic and the reason to flag this is the reason for the accretion of presidential power over so many years was because the president was deemed to be the only entity that could protect us from national security threats. What nobody thought much about is, what if the president himself becomes the national security threat? Then we freed him to become the very kind of king that the entire Constitution was created to remedy or prevent for the future. And that's a very ironic result.
Yeah, I do remember when he said that. And I also remember, though, that one reporter, Caitlin Collins, who was, I think at the time, like 31 years old, looked at him and said, "Now, you know, that's not true. Who told you that?" He didn't get that from Congress or the court, but he got it from a young reporter who happened to be sitting there. It does seem like Congress has sort of stopped legislating. They are having a lot of hearings. They've had 42 of them before they came up with any privacy legislation. And it doesn't feel like there's any momentum. When you look at, and I know you don't think anything is particularly about personalities, but let's looking at the structure of the court. What do you think right now would be animating the court in terms of any future decisions that they make? Let's assume we could have either a President Harris, she's up in the polls as of this recording, or we could have President Trump. Can you see any situations in the future in which they might begin to claw back some of those prior interpretations of the expansiveness of executive authority? In other words, what do you imagine could prompt any kind of a retraction of some of this?
Well, usually Congress acts when they think there's a disaster, and then they try to fix the disaster. The reason I'm flagging it in this book is that I think that these things have been occurring, and everybody says it's personality, so let's just throw the rascals out. If it's structure, then we need to fix the structure, and we need to take more aggressive action. Now, the most graphic illustration of this was after Vietnam and Watergate, the Congress that was elected in 1974 issued a range of structural framework statutes that regulated presidential power and foreign affairs, the War Powers Resolution, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the Intelligence Oversight Act, et cetera, et cetera. After these more recent overextensions of presidential power, Congress has not acted. And the reason is that our foreign policy has become extraordinarily politicized. And that's one of the themes of the latter part of the book. It's important that we think of ourselves as Americans first, not America first, but Americans first. And I think even to the end of the Clinton presidency, into the George H.W. Bush to the Clinton presidency, there was remarkable continuity in foreign affairs between the Republicans and the Democrats. But we now have switched to a kind of zero-sum foreign policy, where the first work of the successor administration is to undo everything that the previous administration did. That's certainly the claimed intention of Trump and J.D. Vance going forward. Trump said quite explicitly that he would resolve the Gulf War and the Russia-Ukraine war by himself within days, using methods that he doesn't disclose. I would make two broad suggestions. One is to make Congress a more effective institution in foreign affairs. One way to do that is to centralize foreign policy expertise in a joint committee on national security. It turns out that we have a joint committee on taxation that has operated very efficiently and not in a partisan fashion for years with an expert staff. And they treat these as more technical issues than they do as political issues. We certainly have experts in Congress on foreign policy of both parties. If they were able to function in a group that got deference from the leadership, that would make a huge difference. A second proposal is that there be a congressional legal advisor. You know, we have many legal advisors in the executive branch who are essentially telling the president, and I was one of them for four different times, as you mentioned, over the course of five decades. They're generally telling the president, there's a way you can do this. So we need someone from Congress, a legal office in Congress, which in an adversarial fashion is challenging that and questioning whether congressional prerogatives under the Constitution are being respected. And then the second innovation is in the court. Number one, I think the court should reject the notion that challenges to these abuse of executive power are non-justiciable. In fact, the Roberts Court has gone some way toward this in that it's sufficiently narrowed the political question doctrine in the Zivotofsky case a few years ago. But then what it does is when it gets to the merits, it tends to validate presidential power. It's in an interesting situation, and the court has recently created something called the major questions doctrine, where if they think that some government action involves a major question, they can step in and say whether the actions are legal or not, and without showing what used to be called Chevron deference. They said that in a case called West Virginia versus the United States, which is about climate change policy. Well, you know, climate change is a global issue. So if they can do that on that issue, do a careful review, why don't they do it in other areas of foreign policy as well, rather than giving deference to what Justice Sotomayor called the national security masquerades?
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policies.